Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
It's all about oil, finances, resources. Climate modification is the covert tool that is being used to hammer countries to the ground all over the globe. It's absolutely going on. And again, I don't want anybody to believe me. Simply look at these dots I'm connecting right now because the trail is there.
On today's It's Our Money, connecting the dots as we walk to the edge of our common understandings about what's really going on in the world of money and power. Are there mega plans for total control of our assets and resources? Might there be some super powerful entities beyond governmental control behind the extremely disturbing changes and developments that we're seeing in our climate and worldwide economic destabilization? Hi, I'm Walt McCree, and today Ellen will be talking with researcher Dane Wigington of the GeoengineeringWatch.org organization about scientific evidence that suggests that there may just be a grand scheme unfolding. Later on in the program, we'll hear from Matt Standard about how economic deprivation was evident in Baltimore's civic uprising. And we'll hear good news out of the Bank of North Dakota once again as it posts yet another record year of profits as America's only public bank. Finally, we'll address a pressing challenge to the sovereignty of American law as the TPP trade agreement nears passage through the U.S. Congress. But now, let's talk with Ellen about her upcoming conversation.
Ellen, your guest this week, Dane Wigington, makes some seemingly preposterous claims about grand schemes that seem to be very difficult to accept on the part of average citizens. In fact, you know, raising them even suggests that there's some conspiratorial matter going on here. And as I thought about it, I said, well, how does this pertain to money? You know, our discussion of money is pretty comprehensive. And then I realized, you know what? We have for decades accepted stories that are part of our history, which have been proved to be false, scandalous shams, really. I mean, I'll give you a simple one. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution started the Vietnam War. Well, that was a complete fraud, and that's one of many, many, many.
I'll give you one other that I just talked about last night. I was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and he wanted to talk about my book, Forbidden Medicine, which was about an alternative cancer therapist in Tijuana who was kidnapped by the FBI, taken to Brownsville, Texas, and tried for fraud, the alleged fraud of representing he had a high rate of success with cancer, which he actually did, in my opinion. And I was one of the attorneys on the case, which we didn't win, and sat through the whole trial and interviewed him for years. He basically, what he got him convicted was radionics, which is a form of energy medicine. But now, in this decade, that's all the hot new rage. Anyway, Jimmy Keller was basically ahead of his time, but got him in jail. Or you could even go all the way back to, who am I thinking of?
Galileo.
Right. Yeah, you can go way back. A lot of people have gotten in trouble for things where they were just ahead of their time.
Well, Dane Wigington is someone who seems to be a credible guy. Why do you think we should believe what he's spelling out in this interview?
Well, the reason I interviewed him was that I had written an article on the California drought, and you can tell by the weather maps. You can watch the weather maps, and you can see this thing called the ridiculously resilient ridge, which is a weather ridge that's keeping storms that usually brew over the Pacific Ocean and then blow onto California. Instead, the jet stream, which used to go south, and for years and years, like decades, it would go south and go over Louisiana and, you know, over the south. And now the jet stream hits that wall and then it goes north. And nobody knows why it goes north. The weather people themselves, it's a mystery why that wall is there. So something is up, something very unnatural is up, that it can't all be global warming because we may be in drought, but at the East Coast in heavy rains and extra cold winters these days. so it's always a question why. You can call it conspiracy theory, but that's just because we don't really know. So we sit around and we speculate
right.
on what could be happening. But something very unusual is happening. There are lots of financial ramifications to the whole thing, as there are, it seems like, everything these days. I just saw that infrastructure is big all around the world now, where big private investor push. It's supposed to be the new investment, like investing mm-hmm. in water is one. Water is supposed to be the new oil. Obviously, everybody needs water. No water, no food. Control food. You control the people, as Henry Kissinger said. But for the big investors, so it's, well, Monsanto-type people, but the big banks, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, and big families like the Bush family, et cetera, they're all buying up land right and left that has water under it, buying up water rights, and trying to buy up water facilities. Like I saw that in New Mexico, Goldman Sachs was trying to buy up, Reno, Nevada, trying to buy up their water facilities. And so the deal would be that they would buy them up and rent them back to the people. So there's this big push to buy everything, buy all the public utilities and rent them back to the people. I know even my neighbor, I was talking to that, and he says, yeah, the government's trying to own everything. And I said, no, I think it's the other way. Whoever, the big private corporate interests are trying to own everything, and they're trying to force the government into privatizing, selling it off cheap, as we've seen has happened all over in third world countries. Or look at Greece as the prime active yeah. example right now. So they're doing that to us, too. They're doing it in Detroit as a very blatant, obvious example. But even in California, we're selling off public assets. So there's that big push, and weather is just one of them, and it could well be that I think it's probably true that the weather is being manipulated by the military. For what reason, we're not sure, but it's definitely affecting investments and affecting our public assets.
And it was in that context that I thought that this was an appropriate conversation to have, because when we talk about what's behind the curtain, as we say at the outset of the show, you know, who's pulling the strings, the monetary strings behind the curtain that we live in on the stage show that we're in, that it's really being managed by secret parties on a grand scale. And to hear of the geoengineering initiative that was started back in the 60s by the United Nations, Dane illustrates in chapter and verse some of the specific indicators of why this may well be happening, and it's as hard to believe as it is that there would be anybody on the planet who would be willing to sacrifice the planet and people for the sake of their self-interest, power, and control. We see it all the time. We see that powers that be are willing to sacrifice the land for fossil fuels. They're willing to sacrifice people through their wars, etc. And so this is the monetary stage that I think we're talking about. And I think your interview with Dane is going to be will be enlightening to our listeners for sure.
And interesting. I mean, nothing else. It's very interesting material. Yeah. Not your usual run-of-the-mill banking stuff.
Thank you for this conversation and getting to hear what he has to say.
My guest today is Dane Wigington, the lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org. Geoengineering is the intentional manipulation of the weather. Dane is a former employee of Bechtel Power Corporation. He was a licensed contractor in California and Arizona, and he has an extensive background in solar energy. He started testing and researching the geoengineering issue about a decade ago when he began to lose significant amounts of solar uptake due to ever-increasing solar obscuration caused by aircraft spraying. He also noted that the forests were dying. He has done many interviews, videos, and blog posts on the environmental dangers we face from geoengineering. So it's great to have this chance to talk to you, Dane.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks. I know you've begun to address this issue as well, and we need all the voices we can on this subject of all the things we face. I would argue,
right. Mathematically,
climate engineering is the most far-reaching.
I wrote an article recently on the California drought, and it prompted a lot of feedback on geoengineering, which is a bit afield from what we usually talk about in this program. It's normally about money and banking and how we can get the money power back by forming our own publicly owned banks. but I heard your recent interview with Greg Hunter on USAWatchdog.com, where you said that if the weather is actually being manipulated, as it appears, money issues will soon be irrelevant. It won't matter what we invest in or what sort of banks we form. We will no longer have an inhabitable planet. you've also spoken or written about some specific financial ramifications of geoengineering. But before we get into all that, I was wondering if you could tell us some more about your background and how you got into this subject yourself.
Well, it's certainly not a job I wanted. And again, as I stated many times, I've never been an activist, not politically oriented. And I found myself in a battle that I never imagined spending the last 12 years on. But when I moved to the Pacific Northwest, built a large off-grid home, solar, wind, and hydro, and I began to lose huge amounts of my solar power from whatever these aircraft were leaving behind. I mean, it was clear something very radical was going on in our skies, and I was astounded to find the mountain of data on solar radiation management, stratospheric aerosol geoengineering, stratospheric aerosol injection. Those are the science terms that describe what's happening in our skies. The science terms are important if people want to get traction. So I began testing the precipitation. Precipitation is reflective on what is in the atmosphere. Found the same materials named in primary geoengineering patents, aluminum, barium, in large and ever-increasing amounts. I did not want to find this material, did not want to believe this was going on in my skies, but you simply can't block that much sun without spraying a particulate into the sky, and that's the express goal of solar radiation management. So knowing all this was raining down on me, contaminating every breath, toxifying everything in my forest, and all of us globally, I mean, you're just simply faced with a decision. Do you engage in this all-important battle, or do you shove your head in the sand? And I that's not an option for me. So I find myself with my life on hold for 12 years, engaged in this battle.
Mm-hmm. And so what, like, hard data for people that are that question whether this is going on at all, what proof do you have?
Here's the bottom line. We have film footage of these crimes happening at altitude. We have up-close film clips of military tankers spraying at altitude, KC-10s, KC-135s, C-17 Globemasters, nozzles visible, turning on and off. We have up-close photos of these nozzles mounted right behind the aircraft to make it appear as if this is some sort of, quote, condensation trail. And again, that's the big lie, that this is condensation. Anyone who really wants to know the truth should investigate a high-bypass turbofan jet engine, which is basically a jet-powered fan. 85% of the air that passes through that engine is non-combusted. It's nearly incapable of making any condensation trail except under the most extreme circumstances. We should see nothing behind these jet aircraft. All military tankers, all commercial jet aircraft have this type of engine. So, again, we have film footage of these aircraft spraying, photos of the nozzles, and we have a mountain of the same materials named in climate engineering patents raining down on us. And for example, in California, Ellen, a lot of people want to grab at the straw that this is all floating over from China. But we have air studies from California Air Resources Board stating conclusively on the record these metals are not amongst what they're finding floating over from China. These metals don't float across oceans. Mercury does because it converts to a gaseous state. So we have a lot of the coal-fired power plant mercury floating over on us. But quite simply, there's no other place these metals can come from. And there's so much of it falling on us, Alan. Our soils in Northern California, we have solid USDA baselines for these soils, and the alkalinity has changed 10 to 12 times toward alkaline in 10 years. It's killing everything. Wow. There's so much metal in our rain, it's killing everything.
So what metals are we talking about? I've read about aluminum, which I know causes Alzheimer's and autism.
Aluminum causes a lot of things. Yeah. Aluminum causes a fact. There's not much aluminum doesn't cause. So we have Alzheimer's, ADD, autism, dementia. We know aluminum now. I had meetings with a bioscientist at Stanford. Aluminum is being connected with type 2 diabetes, obesity, and you have synergistic toxicity. So we have primary metals in the patents, aluminum, barium, manganese, lead, copper. But when you mix these metals together, Ellen, you get synergistic toxicity. So you have a very lethal mix indeed. And again, as I said in the beginning of the program, the ramifications of climate engineering cross every boundary. They permeate every aspect of our society, including financial. In fact, the financial ramifications are massive,
absolutely massive. So while the ship is going down, and as I stated in other shows and you mentioned earlier, if we don't deal with this, no part of the financial system or any other aspect of our current societal paradigm is going to matter. But while the ship is sinking, we have a huge, huge financial aspect to these programs. We have virtual gaming casinos betting on weather derivatives run by the very people who are impacting the weather. The foxes running the hen houses, if you will.
I did see that the Air Force had come out with a paper called Owning the Weather by 2025, and I think the argument was that, well, you have mentioned there are 150 patents on geoengineering, and why would they be doing it? Why would they have these patents if they're not actually experimenting with them? But the argument for us owning the weather is that the tools are available, and if we don't do it, somebody else will, and therefore we have to do the research and be prepared so that we can keep the others from doing it. And I guess it was actually a treaty against using weather manipulation for military purposes. So now the argument is that they're using it to counteract climate change, which has been declared a national emergency, which makes it effectively a military issue, so they can do it all in secrecy and get away with it. Am I correct on that?
Correct in all counts. The philosophy that you mentioned in the beginning, if we don't do it, someone else will, that's in this case about like saying, if we don't sink the ship, somebody else will. Mm-hmm. It's still not a very rational philosophy, although it is correct. You are correct that that is their philosophy. The treaty you referred to in 1976 after the U.S. was so successful with weather modification in the Vietnam War, Project Popeye, that in 76 the UN banned weather modification for wartime purposes. And what was not in that treaty is use of these techniques over a military-zoned country. So nobody pays attention to these UN regulations anyway. No one does. So the ramifications of these programs is absolutely immense and affecting, mathematically speaking, it's affecting everything in our biosphere. Financially speaking, it's a complete cataclysm with those at the top, those that are involved with these programs, making a mint along the way. It's the pirates filling their loot while the ship sinks, and that's exactly what we have going on at a scale that can barely be comprehended.
What's so insidious about the whole idea is that if you set off a bomb somewhere, it's obvious that you've done something military. But if the climate moves in some way, you can't put your finger on it. You can't prove that it was done. So they can get away with a lot, assuming they are doing it. I mean, I've been following this sort of thing ever since the tsunami in Asia. There are just so many suspicious things about that tsunami. It just didn't happen in the ordinary way. I mean, I just read about it. I have never ventured into writing about it. I write about much more conservative things like how we can fix our banking system, and I'm working with legislators. I mean, I don't want to go too far over the edge here, but there was just for interesting reading, there's a lot of suspicious things about a lot of climate things happening or climate disasters happening. I'll just broach one more. I don't know, my co-host may delete this, but I read before the Fukushima disaster, Benjamin Fulford, who is, you know, not necessarily a credible source, but he's totally interesting. In I think it was November or December before the Fukushima disaster, that he had interviewed Heiji Takanaka, who is the finance minister for Japan. He had interviewed him earlier, and he said, "Why have you sold out the Japanese to, you know, to big Western financial interests?" And Heiji Takanaka was the man that was responsible for attempting to privatize the Japan Post Bank. And that's why I was looking into it, because I had written about the Japan Post Bank as the largest publicly owned bank in the world, depository bank in the world, and what amazing things they had done with it, how they'd used it to basically fund their government. It was the funding source for their government. And so Heiji Takanaka was attempting to privatize the Japan Post Bank. And he said to Benjamin Fulford, and I read this before the earthquake, he said, because they threatened us with the earthquake machine. And Fulford thought that was over the edge. You know, he didn't know what he was talking about until he looked into it, and then he learned that there were actually HAARP techniques that could actually do this. So to me, that was just too coincidental after that, just recently, now they are privatizing Japan Post Bank. So who knows?
On that note, and your hypothesis with that is exactly on target. Let's back up a little further, and I'll go through this very quickly. First, again, we have documents going back to one document I found in the NASA archives, 1966. People can find this if they Google 1966 government document geoengineering, 80 pages long, 10 major universities involved, about 10 federal agencies involved, outlining the scope and scale of the U.S. National Weather Modification Programs at that time. There's no question these programs are real. They've existed for decades. It's ongoing. So if we move on to, again, the covert weapon it is, which is the ultimate financial weapon as well, the greatest weapon to control everything financial on our globe in many aspects is climate engineering. So back to Japan, they were starting to ally with their regional partners, again, privatizing, disconnecting from the dollar perhaps might have been in the cards somewhere, and then the quake happened. Now, when you have entities like MIT, most people know who MIT is, extremely credible institution, they noted in the atmosphere directly above the epicenter for that quake, and people can search this, please do not believe me, search it, search MIT atmospheric heating Japanese quake, you'll find data on this. Extremely anomalous atmospheric heating, exactly like what we would expect with the globe's ionosphere heaters over the quake epicenter in the days prior to the quake. Now, how does one explain that? And again, they can't explain it, but they are noting it. They're not the only ones to note it. And for those that don't know anything about the ionosphere heaters, these are astoundingly frightening devices. They can heat the atmosphere to 15,000 degrees Fahrenheit or more. This signal can be bounced off the atmosphere down into strata through the ocean. We're talking about, in the case of HAARP alone, 3.5 billion watts. This causes a vibration. And the data to back up the fact that this power transmitted into a seismically sensitive zone can cause tectonic or seismic movement is well noted and not disputed. So, again, how can we throw this out the window? In regard to manipulating the weather, when we have, going back decades, South African countries, sub-Saharan African countries, droughted out to a point where their countries were literally imploding, their economies, and then they allow U.S. occupation into those countries, which is all part of our financial machine, the gathering of resources or controlling of resources, it's hard to ignore this. Let's look at more recently. Let's compare with Japan. Iran has wanted to disconnect from the dollar for a long time. The moment they were about to set their own oil trading bourse up, not using dollars, that's when the droughting out of their country began in earnest. The leaders of Iran have been on the floor of the UN expressing that they've said publicly NATO weather modification programs are causing record drought in our country. Same thing with all the destabilized Middle Eastern countries. It's all about oil, finances, resources. Climate modification is the covert tool that is being used to hammer countries to the ground all over the globe. It's absolutely going on, and again, I don't want anybody to believe me. Simply look at these dots I'm connecting right now because the trail is there.
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of data on your website, too, and a lot of pictures and videos and stuff that I thought were quite compelling. Back to the California drought. So what would be the financial motives there? Let's say it is being manipulated. Well, first of all, what about the data on it being manipulated? You know the data better than I do, so can you go over that?
I do. It's termed the ridiculously resilient ridge. This is a term the meteorologists have come up with. And they've come up with a lot of terms in recent years for things that did not exist before, such as the polar vortex, such as numerous types of cloud formations that did not exist before because climate engineering was not at the scale before. So in the case of California, we have a 2+2=4 equation. We have satellite imagery of the massive aerosol grid pattern spraying, and people can see some of this imagery on geoengineeringwatch.org. We have a gallery of satellite photos. So the grid pattern spraying aerosolizes the atmosphere, makes it more electrically conductive, which makes it more easily manipulated with the ionosphere heaters. Those heaters are basically like microwaving the atmosphere. So you fill it with conductive metallic particulates, and you can move air masses. You can heat the atmosphere to such a degree that you can actually manipulate the jet stream. This is why we see so much
unprecedented jet stream configuration going on. So back to why would they intentionally drought out their own country? First, people have to realize the government is not here to serve the American population. That should be clear for anybody who does any objective research at all. It's about power and control. So when they bring the state to the point it's at now, which is cataclysmic drought, now they've seized water rights. They're controlling water rights in many areas. We see big ag buying up land from formerly independent farmers. We've seen a similar scenario play out in Australia. Huge regions droughted out to where those regions were sold for pennies on the dollar. Multinational ag bought those regions. Now the rain's falling again. People who doubt the weather is this malleable have simply not done their research. So as a financial weapon, if you will, of power, we have everything I just described, Ellen, and we have also the gaming casino, the weather trading derivatives that are going on. Cities, municipalities are now in a position where they're almost being blackmailed into buying this security to hedge against weather disasters that can be brought on at any point in time by the weather makers. It's what we have going on.
Mm-hmm. I saw where the infamous Goldman Sachs had attempted to buy a municipal water facility and lease it back to the city because, of course, they needed the money. And that's the sort of thing we've seen over and over where we've had the privatization of public assets. They're sold off cheaply to some big bank or, you know, some big financial entity, and then we wind up renting something that we formerly owned at a much higher price. Or Enron is another prime example where an energy crisis was created, apparently artificially, and the whole thing was privatized supposedly because competition would make prices cheaper. But of course what happened was that prices were hiked way up, there was this derivatives mess, and Enron went bankrupt, et cetera. So I think that's we see the model in Detroit. We see it all over where that's privatization is the name of the game. They basically want to own everything. I would say about where you say that government is not there to serve us, I actually think there are different elements of the government, and I work with some very well-meaning, or I have worked with some very well-meaning government officials. So I would say that the question is, let's assume this is the military. It's obviously the military doing it. I mean, you can see the military planes doing it. But who controls the military? It's not Congress. It's not the president. We know that even Bush was not allowed to know the top secret things that the military was up to. So it's somebody else. So there are factions. There is some sort of parasitic or some entity or some group has taken over in a sort of mafia-like way. But in general, the government in general, or government officials, many people go into government hoping to serve the people. That's their motivation. But they can't do it because they're locked into this system where they have to go after big money for their political donations, or they just can't get elected. That whole syndrome.
I agree with you on all counts. And again, when I use the term government, I use it loosely. I'm not referring to every individual that has joined or tried to work for the government with the right motives. I certainly know those people exist. But there absolutely does appear to be a core group of power that has nothing to do with elected officials. It's those who pull the levers. Again, it's those who control the money, those who print the money, the central bankers. That's the government at this point. I think it's hard to argue that. And that's where the real epicenter of control comes from. And those who try to fight that system, and I know a number of them who do. In fact, a 30-year fish and game headwater quality biologist that just quit because every time she tried to bring up the contamination that she associates directly with climate engineering and the fallout, she is pounded by her superiors who are more interested in their paychecks and pensions than doing what's right from a public standpoint. Elected officials, Barbara Boxer, Congressman Doug LaMalfa, I've had a recent conversation with him that I publicized. These people are not there to serve the public good, or they're too afraid to speak their mind. I had a personal meeting with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom in his office with his top aide. There's no question they knew the data I presented was authentic. The satellite photos cannot be argued with. They know this is going on, not a word out of them. And there are many people also rattling their cage over this issue. They are simply afraid to speak out. Had a meeting 3 weeks ago in the state capitol with staffers from a congressional rep who told me, we all know this is going on, we don't know what to do. So everything you described is correct. There's good people in the system, but they can't do anything because the power epicenter is above them, and those leverages are too powerful for them to stand up at this point. But if we don't all stand up, again, our financial situations aren't going to matter. Our 401ks aren't going to matter. If the planet doesn't support life, it's game over. And in the meantime, again, the degree to which these weather modification techniques are being used to extort money from municipalities, cities, individuals, of the weather trading derivatives, it's absolutely off the scale, a virtually rigged system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that water is the new oil. It's the big commodity that people will be investing in. So there's obviously big money in it. We've had movies about it going back 100 years, going back to, I think the most famous was Chinatown, where...
Cadillac Desert, Mark Reisner. I read the book, yes, about the water, water trading.
Yeah, and that could be happening today, where it's about water rights and trying to get the water rights.
I would argue it is. It's not just California in dire straits. We have 9 western states in that position. Lake Mead is at record low levels. Las Vegas is about to run out of water. I mean, when you control the spigot, you control the populations. You control the finances of the populations. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. And then you've mentioned, too, that it may look like global warming, but then we have global cooling on the East Coast, and we have more rain on the East Coast. So how do you explain that?
Well, in the case of the East Coast, it's important for people to look at the whole picture. In fact, if they comb Geoengineering Watch, and they can find a number of pieces I've done on this, the most anomalously cold place in the entire world is the eastern half of the U.S. lower 48 for 2 years running. Now, this is not a coincidence. This is completely engineered. The polar vortex, again, which is completely unprecedented prior to the last few years, that is not indicative of the state of the world. Every time they engineer an event, which is constantly, they make the overall warming of the planet worse, not better, shredding the ozone layer, disrupting the hydrological cycle, causing protracted drought, which is killing forests, causing forests to burn to the ground. You can't interfere with these systems without causing massive damage. So those who live in the East who think that everybody who thinks the warming world is warming must be crazy, I simply challenge them. You have to look beyond your own personal horizon. The planet looks flat from any given location, but is it? We know it's not. So the bottom line is the planet is not just warming. It's in meltdown, and this is not about Al Gore. It's not about carbon credits, both of which are shams. It's simply about reality, a bad situation that's being made much worse by climate engineering. And, Ellen, if we look at an example of the Gulf of Mexico, again, this is all back to finances, oil, power, money. The Corexit chemical that was used to hide the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the name certainly doesn't fit its use. Corexit doesn't correct anything. It hides it, and that chemical is banned throughout the globe, but they used it in the Gulf of Mexico for the Gulf oil spill, the Macondo spill, to hide the oil, to make it sink so it would not be visible. The environmental impact reviews said that chemical made the situation 52 times more toxic. But did they care? No. Again, the goal came down to saving the profit bottom line, hiding the spill. And so we have the same sort of scenario going on with the cooling down, the engineered cool downs in the eastern U.S. while the west is virtually frying. We're pushing 100 degrees in Northern California in recent days. So it's confusing and dividing the population at the cost of making the overall warming worse. And I want to stress this. These materials falling from the sky are highly toxic. We're all breathing them. And look at the bonanza that's being made by the medical industry. Let's weave this into one more financial area. Every other commercial is a commercial for allergy this and respiratory that. I mean, it's epidemic. So we have the pharmaceutical industry making a fortune off the fallout from these programs. And again, mathematically speaking, the greatest source of atmospheric particulates is from climate engineering that we're all breathing. We have the medical industry making an absolute fortune. So we have the disaster capitalists that are mopping up off the cataclysm from every angle in this scenario. It's astounding. But if it continues, none of that will matter, as I said. We're going to be looking at a planet that won't support life.
Mm-hmm. I think you wrote, or I've seen anyway, that Monsanto is making an aluminum resistant GMO seed. So that almost seems conclusive to me. Why would you need an aluminum resistant seed unless aluminum is being dropped on the ground somehow? Because aluminum is a natural component of the soil, right? But what you're talking about is could you explain that about the free aluminum?
Yes. And your example is important. It's yet one more disaster capitalist in this equation, Monsanto. So they have engineered aluminum-resistant seeds. They've engineered drought-resistant, abiotic stress-resistant seeds, and UV-resistant seeds. So all of these issues are directly related to climate engineering. And on the aluminum issue, a lot of people try to argue, well, it's naturally in soils, but this is true in some regions. Not all regions, but some. But it does not exist in free form in the environment. Aluminum, I want to stress that, aluminum does not exist in free form in the environment. So in order for it to be bioavailable, and it is in the rain now, we know this, it's coming down in massive amounts. So now we have bioavailable aluminum coming down in our rain. Now we need aluminum-resistant seeds. So again, the climate engineering programs are much bigger than Monsanto, and those in power are much higher on the food chain than even Monsanto. But Monsanto is yet another disaster capitalist, like the pharmaceutical companies, like the medical industries, like the derivatives trading organizations. All of these are disaster capitalists that are profiting off climate engineering and on a bigger scale, as you brought up with Japan, as I brought up with other countries, with what's happening to Iran. We have Pakistan. When Pakistan showed resistance to U.S. policy in 2010, they found their country underwater in weeks. Same with Thailand. So you can't even begin to put a financial value on whether trading derivatives. It's the greatest covert weapon, period. And the fact that it's national security, as you correctly stated, means they don't have to say anything. They don't have to tell anyone. And anyone, Ellen, who thinks that this wouldn't be going on, when we have the top U.S. military leaders stating climate change is the greatest national security threat, anyone who thinks that they wouldn't be fully deployed in these programs is simply not living in reality.
And I think about Henry Kissinger's line, control oil and you control nations, control food and you control the people. It could be arguably, if you want to get heavily conspiratorial, that the goal here is to eliminate organic food. California is the biggest producer of organic food in the country, 80% of organic food. So if all the ground has aluminum on it, so that you have to use GMO seeds, there will be no such thing as organic food. You will have to go to Monsanto, which will control the food source, and assuming that Monsanto has big elite interests controlling them, that would all fit in that particular scenario. Anyway, that's possible.
It does fit. You're correct. It's all the above. You're exactly correct. And above that, still, I would one more thing to point out is that 65 years of hampering and derailing the climate system has done now immense and irreparable damage. So now we have another aspect of this issue, damage control and hiding the cataclysm that's unfolding. They have unleashed climate feedback mechanisms that now can't be turned off. Methane mass expulsion is one of those mechanisms. It's happening now. I challenge people to search Arctic methane emergency. We have cataclysmic amounts of methane now releasing from the Arctic. Climate engineering has been a major causal factor in triggering this release. Now they're simply trying to hide the gravity of what's unfolding by manipulating the climate even more. So we have methane filling the atmosphere right now. We have a power structure that's desperately trying to hide this fact from public view as long as possible with the same programs, the same climate engineering that helped to trigger this in the first place. So this is the true definition of insanity.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. That's been really interesting. It's been really great talking to you.
You as well, Ellen. Thank you for helping us to sound the alarm. And again, everybody from their own home computer can do a tremendous amount to help bring this issue to light. We must reach critical mass of awareness, and I hope everybody will make their voice heard in this battle. I hope geoengineeringwatch.org is a resource. There is no advertisement on our site, no politics. We simply are trying to sound the alarm.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Dane, and thanks for your hard work.
Thank you, Ellen.
My guest today has been Dane Wigington of geoengineeringwatch.com.
This program looks at the broad impact that our monetary policies make on the Earth and its people. That impact was on full display recently in Baltimore.
I'm Matt Stannard with your public banking report. There's no shortage of pundits condemning the riots in Baltimore. But in order to understand the real forces at work, we need to talk economics. As Harlan Green of PopularEconomics.com writes, the Baltimore riots are the result of an economic system that can only be described as broken, where the bullies win, everyone else loses. How did the economic bullies win in Baltimore? Well, there's at least two different ways. The first is the actions of J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Barclays, Citibank, and Deutsche Bank, who, according to a lawsuit filed by Baltimore City and dozens of other cities and states, manipulated interest rates on hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of loans and investments. Those banks robbed Baltimore and other cities of millions of dollars in returns on investments such as interest rate swaps, risky financial instruments that big banks forced cities to use in order to fund transit systems, schools, waterworks, and other city services. As the Washington Post reported in 2012, those investment earnings allegedly lost in the swap deal could have helped cash-strapped Baltimore balance its budget without resorting to all the service cuts and payroll reductions that it was forced into during the financial crisis. Those cuts, of course, were devastating, thrusting residents of Baltimore into unemployment, stripping the city of its mechanisms of connecting the community with vital resources. The second cause of the devastation in Baltimore is the subprime mortgage crisis, of which University of Michigan professor Martha Jones writes, "When examining the tensions that erupted in Baltimore in the last 2 weeks, the consequences of losing homes should not be minimized as a factor in the sense of outrage and injustice." Although corporatist propaganda blames the borrowers and the government for this mess, the true culprits were a by now familiar bunch: asset managers turning to high-yield mortgage-backed securities and turning a blind eye to their due diligence responsibilities; credit agencies who lied about the value of those junk securities; bankers pushing unstable derivatives, all undergirded by a Wall Street compensation system rewarding short-term performances rather than long-term stability or genuine improvement in borrowers' lives. Economically disenfranchised, hounded by creditors and predators, Baltimore was ripe for unrest, not because of people with bad attitudes, but because of economic mismanagement at the hands of a largely white, wealthy power base on Wall Street. While there are many political solutions to disenfranchisement, the challenge of economic solutions remains hindered by the reliance of cities like Baltimore on Wall Street finance. That reliance continues to cost cities dearly, as revelations surface of big banks taking billions of dollars from city budgets and pensions for service fees and through astronomical interest rates. Wall Street just apparently can't help itself. It just can't help doing what it does. And even with crumbling cities and broken bodies all around it, it just keeps on going. So solutions should start as far away from Wall Street as possible. Instead of entrusting city budgets, mortgages, and credit to big private banks, a public bank, like the Bank of North Dakota, would not only avoid risky derivatives and other disaster-inducing speculations, but would, in partnering with local banks to strengthen capital and deposit bases, keep loans on its books rather than being forced to sell them off to investors. Such public banks would be literal manifestations of economic democracy, since like the BND, their deposits would be comprised of tax collections and public fees, and their charters would mandate lending in the public interest, with their modest profits being returned to government coffers rather than siphoned off by aloof shareholders. Last year, North Dakota got a 17.6 return rate on its BND investments. Imagine what that would mean to cities like Baltimore. These material causes should not be interpreted to imply that deep-seated institutional and personal racism is not also at work in Baltimore and other cities. There are many good activists and scholars examining and calling out that racism, but financially empowered local communities will be in infinitely better shape to fight such racism, render it materially irrelevant, and help those communities build their own locally responsive centers of power. After all, it's their money. I'm Matt Stannard.
Well, we just heard about how the economic deprivation in Baltimore and other U.S. cities has taken communities over the edge of stability and into a seemingly unending downward spiral of debt that robs them of their futures and their security. But a singular oasis of consistent economic vitality is nurtured by America's only public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, which recently released its annual report. The BND has just had another record year of profits, its 11th in a row over a 40-year growth period, and that includes the recent years of bank failures and economic collapses everywhere else. We spoke with Commonomics USA founder Mark Armstrong about how this public bank manages to outperform all the others.
One of the reasons why the revenues and the profits are growing is because in the late 80s they decided to implement a much more robust set and diverse set of loan programs, so that they now have well over 25 loan programs in place, most of which are for commercial enterprises. And so what they're able to do is use these loan programs to either attract business to North Dakota or fund business expansion. They do a number of things with these loan programs, and including student loans. And so They're pretty innovative in terms of how they use the structure of a bank to develop margins of the economy. And in the case of students, they want to retain students there in North Dakota. So one of the loan programs is to consolidate their private and federal loans into a low-interest loan package, which Bank of North Dakota provides. And so there are a number of things, important economic issues, such as attracting businesses or making sure you have an educated workforce. These are things which everybody talks about, but Bank of North Dakota is doing something about it.
The student loan portfolio thing, the program is called Deal One. What kind of financing does the state offer students?
Well, what they do is they provide these loans to students who have gone to different schools. It doesn't matter if that school has been in North Dakota or not, but yes, they have to be living in North Dakota. They have to have these various different student loans in place that they're working to pay off. And what Bank of North Dakota does is simply say, well, what we'll do is consolidate all those loans into one monthly payment. And they've been able to reduce some of the interest rates from as high as 14%+ to something much more reasonable, like around 5% for fixed rate, 1%+ for a variable rate. So as a result, you've got an economic incentive for young workers who have skills to stay in North Dakota and apply their skills in order to make money and pay off these loans.
And apparently it's profitable. I mean, they're 1.75% APR for a student loan. It's still a pretty good return. And the state seems to be satisfied with that, yeah?
Yeah, it's definitely profitable, and the primary reason is because they are an efficient back office. They excel in providing back office services to lending portfolios. They provide a lot of the servicing associated with it, so they do the billing and follow-up, et cetera, that they need to do. They have one location, and so they know how to keep their costs low.
So they're doing residential students, agriculture and business loans. How have they responded to or related to the fracking business, the oil and gas industry that's affected the state so much?
They only have about a little over 20%, I think it's 22% of their commercial lending portfolio in the oil country. And so they feel they're not exposed at all to the vagaries, for lack of a better term, the vagaries of the oil business. And so it's not too concentrated a risk. And this report proves, at least for 2014, that if they did suffer any losses because of the declining oil revenue in the second half of 2014, it certainly didn't show up on their bottom line. I mean, they still have a year-to-year growth in net profit and have set another record in terms of overall net profit. So they're a very well-managed bank in terms of not taking too risky a position in a particular economic sector. When you compare Bank of North Dakota to any other state producing oil and gas, the record shows that North Dakota did not suffer a credit contraction at all 2008, 2009, 2010, and many of these other states, whether it's Pennsylvania or California, not only suffered credit contraction, but also had declining revenues associated with the fee oil and gas fee revenues into the state coffers. And so, as a result, you ended up with a situation where North Dakota came through the recession with flying colors, and these other states suffered significantly.
That was Commonomics USA founder Mark Armstrong, who suggests that you visit the online 2014 annual report for the Bank of North Dakota to review the many interesting loan applications that the bank has created to meet a variety of community needs that are simply not done elsewhere. Reflecting again on Baltimore's economic issues, we spoke with Dr. Emma Chappelle, a venerable banker in Philadelphia, about how a public bank could make a real difference in solving urban problems through financial collaboration with area stakeholders.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been in banking over 40 years, and I have found that when I was creating United Bank of Philadelphia, people thought that there was no way that we could serve or address urban problems. And one of the things I found that once we started doing that, we got a tremendous amount of support from both the private individual as well as the corporate community, because we were able to educate them on where the need was. And once we did that, it flew. But what we have to do is devise a method where the bank will not be harmed, that's the public bank, as when we go to provide the services that are needed in this community.
So with those examples of success demonstrated by North Dakota's public bank and the ingenuity of community-focused bankers, there's a bright spot on the horizon of the banking profession that can help to build a new prospect for the American economy. Our thanks to Mark Armstrong of Commonomics USA and Dr. Emma Chappelle of the United Bank in Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania Project. The clock is ticking, and faster every day, as the Trans-Pacific Partnership so-called trade deal moves its way through the halls of Congress. I talked with Ellen about what the implications of this very significant piece of legislation could mean.
We're really up against it here now, aren't we? The TPP represents a real challenge to our ability to do business as we wish. How would that affect the public banking prospect as you understand it?
Well, what we're up against right now is that it just got out of committee in both houses, so it's going to the floor, I guess. But hopefully they don't have the votes, but that's why they want a big push from people to contact your congressman. And I mean, there are all kinds of websites you can join. Flush the TPP would be Kevin Thies and Margaret Flowers' site, which I would recommend. They're trying to fast-track it through. It's all very secret right now, even though they claim it's not. It clearly is. You can't read the thing unless you're a legislator, and you can't take notes. You can't take somebody with you. You can't take your computer. You've got to basically memorize whatever it is you want to know, and you have to know the specific section you want to look at when you go in there. So it's all very dark, and we don't know really what's in it, and they're trying to push it through, because if they don't push it through, it won't pass. That's the thought. But why do you want something to pass that wouldn't pass if it saw the light of day? But how it would affect public banks is that there's a provision in it, the ISDS provision, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Mechanism, where if big investors, like big banks, big corporate interests find that some legislation that one of the signatories to this treaty passes, and it affects 40% of GDP globally, so it's a huge trade agreement. If one of those signatories passes legislation that interferes with the profits of one of these companies, they can sue and they can get their lost future profits. So these ISDS clauses have been in there for a long time, since I think 1959 was the first one, but they used to make more sense, like an oil company in Venezuela which decided to nationalize oil. It would make sense that you would get compensated for your oil rigs or whatever improvements you had made. But now they're allowing big banks, for example, or for any big investors to sue for their lost profits. And who knows how big those are. So no legislation is going to get passed in the future because the legislators are going to say, well, we'll take the risk that we might step on somebody's turf, and then they'll sue us for what they thought they were going to make on that. And it'll be too prohibitively expensive. And one thing that they could block as interfering with their profits would be new public banks that would get set up, because they'll say, wait, like let's say California set up a state-owned bank. Let's say California is currently putting their deposits in Chase or in Bank of America. Those big banks could turn around and say, wait, we're losing all the money that we were making on your deposits. We were using that, leveraging that money, and doing all that. We were investing in all these things with your money, and now we can't do that anymore, so we're losing all those profits, and so you owe us. I mean, it's dodgy enough getting legislators to do something new. And if they're going to have the potential downside of any profits that they might make at the expense of, you know, that somebody else is currently making, they're not going to do it.
We are living in a very pivotal time, it seems, where the scales are being heavily balanced against the interests of people.
Yeah, so, government yeah. by big corporations. You can see the TPP in the drought and so forth, that there are people making water profits off of the price of water going up because it's going to become scarce. They'll say, yeah, but we were making good profits off that, so you owe us.
Well, Alan, thank you for this conversation and also for your interview with Dane, and we'll pick it up from there.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks, Walt.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness, and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.